Hello and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for October 25, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. The headline on the front page reads, Israel strikes surge. Health authorities in Gaza say hundreds of Palestinians killed. Israel escalated airstrikes across the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, crushing families in the rubble of residential buildings, as health officials said hundreds of Palestinians were killed and medical facilities were shut down because of bomb damage and lack of power. The soaring death toll from Israel's bombardment is unprecedented in the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It augurs an even greater loss of life in Gaza once Israeli forces, backed by tanks and artillery, launch an expected ground offensive aimed at crushing Hamas militants. Gaza's 2.3 million people have been running out of food, water, and medicine since Israel sealed off the territory after the devastating October 7 attack by Hamas on towns in southern Israel. The Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas, said Israeli airstrikes killed at least 704 people over the prior day, mostly women and children. The Associated Press could not independently verify the death tolls cited by Hamas, which says it tallies figures from hospital directors. Israel said Tuesday it launched 400 airstrikes over the prior day. A group of Hamas divers that tried to infiltrate Israel on a beach just north of Gaza on Tuesday were confronted by naval forces, the Israeli military said. Across central and south Gaza, where Israel previously told civilians to take shelter, there were scenes of rescuers pulling the dead and wounded out of large piles of rubble from collapsed buildings. Graphic photos and video shot by the Associated Press showed rescuers unearthing bodies of children from multiple ruins. Buildings that collapsed on residents killed dozens at a time in several cases, witnesses said. Two families lost 47 members in a leveled home in Rafah, the health ministry said. A strike on a four-story building in Khan Yunis killed at least 32 people, including 13 members of the Sakala family, said Amar al-Bouta, a relative who survived the airstrike. He said there were about 100 people sheltering in the building, including many who evacuated from Gaza City. We thought that our area would be safe, he said. Another strike destroyed a bustling marketplace in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, witnesses said. AP photos showed the floor of a vegetable shop covered in blood. In Gaza City, at least 19 people were killed when an airstrike hit the house of the Balul family, according to survivors, who said dozens more people remained buried. The health ministry said more than 5,700 Palestinians have been killed in the war, including some 2,300 minors. The fighting killed more than 1,400 people in Israel, mostly civilians slain during the initial Hamas attack, according to the Israeli government. As the death toll in Gaza spirals and fuel supplies dwindle, the number of facilities able to deal with casualties is shrinking. More than half of primary health care facilities and about one of every three hospitals have stopped functioning, the World Health Organization said. Overwhelmed hospital staff struggled to triage cases as constant waves of wounded were brought in. The health ministry said many wounded are laid on the ground without even simple medical intervention, and others wait for days for surgeries because there are so many critical cases. While Israel allowed a small number of trucks filled with aid to enter, it barred deliveries of fuel to Gaza, saying it wants to keep it out of Hamas hands. The UN said its operation distributing aid will halt Wednesday evening if it does not receive fuel. To make room for the dead, cemeteries have been forced to excavate and reuse old plots, Families have dug trenches to bury multiple bodies at a time. Bodies pour in by the hundreds every day. We use every empty inch in the cemeteries, said Abdel Rahman Mohammed, a volunteer who helps transfer bodies to Khan Yunis main cemetery. Israel claims it does not target civilians and that Hamas militants are using them as cover for their attacks. Palestinian militants have fired over 7,000 rockets at Israel since the start of the war, according to Israel, and Hamas said it fired a fresh barrage on Tuesday. Israel has vowed to destroy Hamas. Iranian-backed fighters around the region warn of possible escalation, including the targeting of U.S. forces deployed in the Middle East, if a ground offensive is launched. Israel and Hezbollah have traded fire almost daily across the Israel-Lebanon border. Also on the front page, an article entitled "Georgia Prosecutors Are Picking Up Cooperators in Trump Election Case. Will It Matter?" Sidney Powell was present for a now infamous December 2020 meeting at the White House, where participants hatched far-fetched schemes to keep Donald Trump in power, and was so tied to the then president that he once considered naming her a special counsel to probe claims of election fraud. Kenneth Cheesebrough was part of a small coterie of advisors who prosecutors say prodded Republicans in battleground states to submit slates of fake electors who would falsely assert that Trump, not Democrat Joe Biden, was victorious. Yet rather than continue to stand behind Trump, the two lawyers cut deals last week with prosecutors in Fulton County, Georgia, agreeing to plead guilty and cooperate instead of face trial in the indictment that charged them, the ex-president and 16 others, with illegally plotting to overturn the 2020 election. The deals ensure the cooperation of two witnesses who could presumably offer insider accounts of the desperate scheming to help Trump remain president, a boon for prosecutors striving to develop incriminating evidence against higher-profile targets. Even so, it's hard to forecast how much their assistance heightens the legal peril for Trump, especially since Powell's own history of outlandish and ill-supported claims of fraud could open her to attacks on her credibility and a bruising cross-examination. It's not a slam dunk that she is the knife to the heart of the former president, but it's not a good day for him when she pleads guilty, John Fishwick, a former U.S. attorney for the Western District of Virginia, said of Powell. She's going to do something that hurts him. The level of the hurt, we don't know yet. Neither agreement. Powell pleaded guilty to misdemeanor charges, Cheesebrough to a felony, called for prison time. That's a generous resolution for two defendants alleged to have played significant roles in what Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis has called a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result. But such an outcome could nonetheless signal to other defendants the benefits that await them if they, too, plead guilty, while also helping prosecutors winnow down an unwieldy racketeering case so they can focus their attention on even bigger names. In terms of immediate things that might shake out of it, I think it's a question of what the people next down in the pecking order might do in order to free up the DA's office a little bit more, said Anthony Michael Kreis, a Georgia State University law professor. I think that's really what the DA's office is trying to do now. They're trying to shake as many of these co-defendants loose as they can and focus on the people they want to focus on and just step on the accelerator and get things moving. Beyond the Georgia case, the cooperation could potentially aid Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith, who in August charged Trump with conspiring to undo the election. Powell and Cheesebrough are referenced, though not by name, as unindicted co-conspirators in that case, making their statements to investigators in Georgia of potential interest to Smith in his prosecution of Trump, which is set for trial next March. There is considerable overlap in the case that Jack Smith has charged and the case that Fani Willis has charged, said Jessica Roth, a professor at Cardozo School of Law. They're clearly part of the story in Jack Smith's indictment. The plea deals ushered in a predictable pattern of once close Trump allies turning against him in their own interests, followed by Trump moving to distance himself from them. That happened Sunday when Trump posted on social media in capital letters that Powell was not my attorney and never was. The about-face was striking, given that just 3 years ago, Trump introduced Powell on the social media platform, then known as Twitter, as part of his, quote, great legal team, close quote, challenging election results. That same month, she filed a since-dismissed lawsuit attacking Georgia's election results that was embraced by Trump and was part of a news conference with two fellow Fulton County co-defendants, Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis, where baseless claims of vast election fraud were raised. Powell also participated in a raucous meeting at the White House 1 month later with the then president, where Trump allies discussed potentially invoking the Insurrection Act as a way to seize voting machines. That might be one small part of the picture that nobody else can paint, and that is particularly damning for Donald Trump in terms of showing that this was not a good faith effort to ensure the election's accuracy, but rather was a bad faith effort to overturn it, Christ said. Even so, he noted, she'd likely be an easy witness for the Trump team to attack, potentially lessening the impact of any testimony she'd give. Smith's indictment notes Trump privately told others that he thought her election fraud ideas sounded crazy, and Giuliani and Ellis moved to separate themselves from her days after their news conference, in which Powell incorrectly suggested that a server hosting evidence of voting irregularities was located in Germany, that voting software used by Georgia and other states was created at the direction of late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, and that votes for Trump had probably been switched in favor of Biden. Not only is she easy to discredit, I think she'd be a very hostile witness, Christ said. Campaigning in New Hampshire on Monday, Trump appeared to refer to Powell and Cheeseboro as good people and said prosecutors worked to hound and scare them. Steve Sadow, Trump's lead attorney in the Georgia case, expressed confidence that Powell's plea wouldn't hurt Trump, saying last week that any truthful testimony offered would be favorable to my overall defense strategy. The Georgia indictment accuses Powell in a plot to illegally access a county's voting equipment. In Cheeseboro's case, though prosecutors don't say he communicated directly with Trump, he's alleged to have played an instrumental role in a scheme underpinning both the Georgia prosecution and the federal prosecution efforts to enlist fake electors in battleground states won by Biden. Georgia prosecutors say had the case gone to trial, they would have shown Cheeseboro conspired with Trump, Giuliani, and conservative law professor John Eastman and others to get several Georgia Republicans to falsely present themselves as the state's, quote, duly elected and qualified, close quote, electors to, quote, disrupt and delay, close quote, the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021. Cheeseboro's lawyer said last week that he didn't foresee his client's cooperation harming Trump. But nonetheless, the fake elector plot is being investigated in multiple states and is much more a central part of the overall conspiracy, said George Washington University law professor Randall Eliason. That could make his cooperation important in implicating others. Anytime that you've got co-conspirators pleading guilty and admitting to engaging in criminal activity, that's pretty significant, he said. On page 2, we find an article entitled Strikes Trim Profit at General Motors. A strike by auto workers against General Motors is expected to cut pre-tax earnings by $800 million this year, and another $200 million per week after that, the company's chief financial officer said. Those figures include only factories that are on strike now, so if more plants are added by the United Auto Workers Union, the losses will pile up further, CFO Paul Jacobson told reporters. Shortly after the conference's call, the UAW expanded the strike to Arlington, Texas, one of GM's most profitable plants. 5,000 workers walked off their jobs at the factory, which makes SUVs. GM on Tuesday posted net income of more than $3 billion from July through September, down 7% from the same period last year due to lost production from the strike, and also increased warranty costs, Jacobson said. The company also withdrew its previous full-year pre-tax earnings estimates, citing uncertainty over the length of the strike and how many factories would be shut down. However, excluding one-time items, GM said it made $2.28 per share, handily beating Wall Street estimates of $1.87. Revenue of $44.13 billion rose 5.4% and also exceeded estimates of $42.48 billion, according to data provider FactSet. The UAW has been on strike since September 15, nearly 6 weeks, against GM and its Detroit competitors, Ford and Jeep maker Stellantis. The union had spared factories that make GM's most profitable vehicles, pickup trucks and large SUVs, from its targeted strikes. Yet the UAW is demonstrating this week that risks to those money-making facilities can rise the longer the strike goes on. On Monday, the union shut down Stellantis' huge Ram pickup truck plant north of Detroit in Sterling Heights, Michigan. 2 weeks ago, workers walked off their jobs at Ford's largest and most profitable plant, one that makes pickups and big SUVs in Louisville, Kentucky. So far, only 28% of the union's 146,000 members at the Detroit 3 are on strike. Jacobson said third quarter strike loss was $200 million, since the walkouts were only in effect the final 2 weeks of the period. He predicted another $600 million of losses from October through December. In a note to shareholders, CEO Mary Barra said GM made a record offer to the union that will raise top factory pay to $40.39 per hour, or roughly $84,000 a year, in 4 years. It's an offer that rewards our team members but does not put our company and their jobs at risk, Barra wrote. Accepting unsustainably high costs would put our future and GM team member jobs at risk, and jeopardizing our future is something I will not do. Union President Sean Fain says the companies are making billions and paying millions to CEOs so they can afford to pay workers more. The three automakers amassed almost $250 billion in reported profits in their North American operations over the past decade. Edward Jones analyst Jeff Window said investors are concerned about the financial hit from a longer strike, GM slowing electric vehicle productions, and whether it can squeeze out more cost cuts to offset a deal with the union. Our concern is generally making sure the automakers have that flexibility to be able to navigate through a cyclical downturn, he said on Tuesday. Jacobson said many have expressed concerns about GM taking on higher labor costs, but the company planned for it by cutting in other areas. For example, GM's annual fixed costs, will be $2 billion lower than 2022 by the end of 2024, Jacobson said. The company also is slowing electric vehicle productions to adjust to slower short-term growth in demand. Last week, GM announced it postponed production at one Michigan electric pickup truck factory from this year until late 2025 to keep manufacturing in line with demand. That decision will save the company $1.5 billion next year, Jacobson said. Barra said the transition to EVs will be a bit bumpy at times, but GM is prepared to react with agility. As an example, she cited the company's plan to resurrect the Chevrolet Bolt small EV, which the company was to stop making at the end of this year. Now the company will take the attributes of the current Bolt and add new battery and other technology to roll out a new vehicle in 2025. GM is sticking with plans to increase manufacturing capacity to 1 million EVs per year in North America by the end of 2025, he said. But earlier guidance of building 400,000 EVs in North America through the middle of next year were scrapped. Jacobson said GM still expects to start turning low to mid single-digit profit margins on electric vehicles in 2025. Demand for vehicles and prices remained strong through the third quarter, which helped keep GM's profit high. The company's U.S. sales rose 21%, and Jacobson said the average U.S. selling price for GM vehicles was $50,750, down only slightly from the previous quarter. So far, the consumer has held up remarkably well for us, as evidenced by the average transaction prices, Jacobson said. They continue to hang in and I think exceeded most expectations that were set at the beginning of the year. In national and world news, we have an article entitled GOP Nominates Johnson. Republicans try a fourth time to pick a leader after Emmer bows out. House Republicans chose Representative Mike Johnson as their latest nominee for House Speaker on Tuesday, after an earlier pick, Representative Tom Emmer, abruptly withdrew in the face of opposition from Donald Trump and hardline GOP lawmakers. Johnson of Louisiana is a member of House GOP leadership, a lawyer specializing in constitutional issues who rallied Republicans around Trump's legal effort to overturn the 2020 election results. Republicans met late into the evening behind closed doors, desperate to find a leader who can unite the factions, reopen the House, and get the U.S. Congress working again after hard-right members of the party ousted Kevin McCarthy of California from the job 3 weeks ago. Emmer of Minnesota abruptly abandoned his bid to become House Speaker on Tuesday, withdrawing within hours of winning the internal party nomination after Trump objected and hardliners refused to support him for the gavel. While Emmer won a simple majority in a roll call behind closed doors, 117 votes, he lost more than two dozen Republicans, leaving him far short of what will be needed during a House floor tally to be Speaker, a powerful position second in line to the presidency. Emmer, the GOP whip, was the third House Republican to fall short in political infighting. Refusing to unify, far-right members won't accept a more traditional Speaker, and more moderate members don't want a hardliner. Pretty sad commentary on governance right now, said Representative Steve Womack, a Republican from Arkansas. Maybe on the fourth or fifth or sixth or tenth try, we'll get this thing right. Emmer briskly left the building where he had met privately with Republicans, but returned later to offices at the Capitol. He said Trump's opposition did not affect his decision to bow out. I made my decision based on my relationship with the conference, he said, referring to the GOP majority. He said he would support whomever emerges as the new nominee. We'll get it done. Trump, speaking as he left the courtroom in New York, where he faces business fraud charges, said his unendorsement must have had an impact on Emmer's bid. He wasn't MAGA, said Trump, the party's frontrunner for the 2024 presidential election, referring to his Make America Great Again campaign slogan. One idea circulating, first reported by NBC News, was to reinstall McCarthy as speaker with hardline Representative Jim Jordan in a new leadership role. Next, we have an article entitled Trump Fixer Appears in Court. Cohen testifies he was told to inflate values of properties, quote, arbitrarily, close quote. In a courtroom showdown 5 years in the making, Donald Trump's fixer-turned-foe, Michael Cohen, testified Tuesday he worked to boost the supposed value of the former president's assets to, quote, whatever number Trump told us to, close quote. It was a long-awaited face-to-face encounter between Trump and the now disbarred lawyer. Cohen eventually ended up in prison and became a prominent witness against his former boss from courthouses to Congress. Cohen is a key figure in the New York Attorney General Letitia James lawsuit, alleging that Trump and his company duped banks, insurers, and others by giving them financial statements that inflated his wealth. I was tasked by Mr. Trump to increase the total assets based upon a number that he arbitrarily elected, Cohen testified, saying he and former Trump Organization finance chief Alan Weisselberg labored, quote, to reverse engineer the various different asset classes, increase those assets in order to achieve a number that Mr. Trump had tasked us, close quote. Trump denies James' allegations and dismissed Cohen's account outside court as the words of a proven liar who served prison time after pleading guilty to tax evasion, lying to Congress, and campaign finance violations. The former president and Republican 2024 frontrunner voluntarily came to court for the highly anticipated testimony. Cohen previously said he hadn't seen Trump for 5 years until now. Judge Arthur Engoron already ruled that Trump and his company committed fraud, but the trial involves remaining claims of conspiracy, insurance fraud, and falsifying business records. Trump says his assets were actually undervalued, and he maintains that disclaimers on his financial statements essentially told recipients to check the numbers out for themselves. Cohen spent a decade as Trump's fiercely loyal personal lawyer before famously breaking with him in 2018 amid a federal investigation that sent Cohen to federal prison. He is also a major prosecution witness in Trump's separate Manhattan hush money criminal case, which is scheduled to go to trial next spring. James credited Cohen as the impetus for her civil investigation, which led to the fraud lawsuit and trial. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for October 25, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for October 25, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page, an article entitled Safety is, quote, hot button topic, close quote, in Fort Dodge. Gang violence, the homeless population, and the proposed new jail were discussed during the Webster County Safe Communities Coalition's town hall Tuesday night at the Larimar Ballroom. About 24 members of the community attended the event, where Fort Dodge Police Chief Dennis Quinn and Webster County Sheriff Luke Fleener answered questions posed by members of the audience. One of the first questions asked was, how would you suggest handling interacting with the homeless that are walking through a neighborhood and hanging around during the day and potentially on your property. Quinn started by noting that the homeless population in the city has been a, quote, hot-button topic, close quote, for a while now. What I try to remind everybody is that regardless, the homeless are human too, he said. They deserve compassion. They deserve the same things everybody else deserves. I sometimes think that people look at it like, well, we just need to make them disappear. That's not fair. We don't know the story to what that person has been through or where they come from. Quinn said that when the Fort Dodge Police Department is called to a situation involving something like a homeless individual loitering or something like that, he encourages his officers to not just shoo them away every time. Sometimes we've got to try to see if we can help them, he said. One of the ways officers can help is to refer the individual to Brittany Baker, a justice-involved service coordinator for Central Iowa Community Services, who works with the police and sheriff's departments at the Law Enforcement Center. Quinn said officers also have to, quote, look outside the box, close quote, when handling these situations. While the city of Fort Dodge has an ordinance to crack down on loitering downtown because of capacity issues at the Webster County Jail, officers are unable to arrest violators. With Baker as a resource, she's able to help connect those individuals to services that can help get them off the streets and back on their feet. Quinn and Fleener were also asked about gang violence in the area. Quinn said that there are some gangs active in Fort Dodge, but it's hard to put a number to it because some are just small clusters of people and aren't affiliated with any larger, well-known gangs like the Bloods or the Gangster Disciples. Those smaller gangs without a larger affiliation can be hard to track, he said. While we have some gang presence, we're not like Omaha. We don't have that huge amount of people, Quinn said. The chief added that there are some offshoots of these larger gangs from Omaha that are maybe influencing some of those smaller gangs, but we definitely don't have the problem that some people think that Fort Dodge does. Fleener answered a few questions about the proposed $45.5 million new jail project. County voters will take to the polls on November 7 to decide whether the county should take out a 20-year general obligation bond to build a new jail. One person asked if there were any state or federal funding available to offset the property tax impact of the proposal. Fleener answered that it's a county issue, not a state issue, and there aren't any grants to fund the project. If the bond referendum passes, Fleener said, the new jail would be expected to be operational in 2.5 to 3 years. At the end of the meeting, Randy Kuhlman, CEO of the Fort Dodge Community Foundation and United Way, endorsed the jail project. We need a new jail, folks, Kuhlman said, and I know it costs money. I ran the math. If we don't build this new jail now, in 10 years from now, the price will be 50% higher than it is today, and in 20 years, it's doubled. Quinn and Fleener both said about 75% of the criminals their officers deal with on a daily basis are repeat offenders who aren't being held in jail because their offenses may not be violent, so there's no space for them in the jail. If we want our community to be safer, we have to have a new jail so we can house these people and get them off the street, Kuhlman said. None of us want to pay more taxes, I understand that, but we need a new jail, and that's one thing that can really impact the safety of our communities. Also on the front page, another article entitled Webster County Has Outgrown 40-Year-Old Jail, Study Says. Shortly after taking office in 2021, Webster County Sheriff Luke Fleener noticed a line item on his department's budget with an alarming number of zeros following the first digit. It was the cost that the county was paying to house Webster County jail inmates in other county jails, because the existing jail on the third floor of the law enforcement center lacks the capacity to hold everyone in the jail's custody. This year, that line item is set for $373,000. That's more than a third of $1 million of Webster County taxpayer funds being paid out to other counties in the area. In the last 5 years, Webster County has spent more than $1.4 million to house inmates in other jails, a number that includes the cost of the two deputies who are on the road daily transporting inmates to and from court hearings and medical appointments, as well as the fuel costs and wear and tear on their transport vehicles. And that's probably a conservative number, Fleener said at an October 1 informational meeting on the proposed jail. It probably costs a little more than that in 5 years. Fleener said he approached the Webster County Board of Supervisors about 2 years ago to launch a study of whether the existing jail is meeting the county's needs and what solutions are viable to fix the problem. The money that's in the budget of the sheriff's office that we're outsourcing for all these inmates is just unsustainable, Fleener said. For years to come, whether it's in my tenure as the sheriff or the next person that's there, the budget of the county cannot continue to do that. That jail study, commissioned from the Samuels Group, a consulting firm from West Des Moines that specializes in government facilities like county jails, showed a myriad of problems with the existing facility, including the issue of overcrowding. The existing jail, which was built with the LAC in 1982, can house up to 56 inmates and has a footprint of less than 10,000 square feet. However, due to inmate classifications, violent, nonviolent, etc., and potential inmate conflicts, gang affiliations, or co-defendants, the jail isn't always able to hold 56 inmates. As of Tuesday, 18 Webster County inmates are being housed elsewhere. Of the total number of inmates currently in custody, 12 are charged with violent crimes, according to Fleener. The Webster County Sheriff's Office is charged $60 to $100 per day per inmate housed out of the county. In September 2023 alone, Webster County paid $19,000 to other counties to house overflow inmates. On a nearly weekly basis, Fleener said he has to send a list of the inmates to the Webster County Attorney's Office to ask which inmates seem least likely to reoffend and can be released to make space for new arrests. Fleener has said that some of the troublemakers in Webster County have caught wind of that and know that for some offenses they're not likely to be arrested, so they keep committing crimes. The jail's capacity shortfalls doesn't only affect inmates who are awaiting trial. For many misdemeanors, a judge will sentence a defendant to serve a few days, a few weeks, or even a few months in jail for that offense. When there isn't enough space for even the pretrial inmates, there certainly isn't enough space for sentenced inmates. Currently, there are just over 1,000 people who are waiting to serve time they've been sentenced to. That waiting list is at least 5 years long, Fleener said. People will call in all the time to ask if there's space so they can serve their short sentences and close out their cases, but jail staff have to turn them away. That's also a huge chunk of money that the county could be collecting. Inmates serving sentences for convictions are required to pay $100 per day in housing costs. With those 1,000-plus individuals and their 7,398 days of sentences, that's nearly $740,000 waiting to be collected. Those individuals' cases can remain open in the courts until their sentences are discharged. The proposed 60,692-square-foot facility that would house both the jail and the sheriff's office is the solution to the county's overcrowded jail problem, the study by the Samuels Group concluded. The proposed facility would have 61 general population cells, double bunked, and 8 special needs cells with one bunk, totaling 130 beds. It would also include space for jail administration, sheriff's office administration, patrol, investigations, and civil processing. To pay for the construction of the facility and the acquisition of the land on which to build, a $45.5 million 20-year general obligation bond referendum will be on the November 7 ballot. The Samuels Group has launched a website to educate voters on the proposal. Voters can also go to the website to calculate the exact impact they would see on their property taxes if the referendum passes. The dates and times of public information meetings are also listed on the website. The website is www.webstercountyvote.com. At the informational meetings on the jail referendum, Fleener has assured residents that regardless of how the vote goes, he and his department will keep running the Webster County Jail to the best of their ability with the resources they have, which will almost certainly mean continuing to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money to outsource jail inmates. On page 2, we find an article entitled Bird Flu Resurfaces in Iowa. Turkey facility in Pocahontas County is affected. Two commercial turkey farms in Iowa have been hit by the re-emerging highly pathogenic bird flu, causing about 100,000 birds to be killed to prevent the disease from spreading. The Iowa Department of Agriculture reported the infected commercial poultry flocks within weeks of a turkey farm in South Dakota and one in Utah, reporting the first outbreaks in the U.S. since April, raising concerns that more would follow. The U.S. Department of Agriculture shows 12 commercial flocks in South Dakota, Utah, and Minnesota have been affected in October, totaling more than 500,000 birds. Bird flu last year cost U.S. poultry producers nearly 59 million birds across 47 states, including egg-laying chickens and turkeys and chickens raised for meat, making it the country's deadliest outbreak ever, according to USDA figures. The outbreak caused spikes in egg and turkey prices for consumers and cost the government over $660 million. Iowa was the hardest hit state last year, with nearly 16 million birds lost. But there hadn't been a case reported in the state since March. Iowa's department reported Friday that one commercial turkey facility of about 50,000 birds in Buena Vista County was affected. Another facility of about 47,500 turkeys in neighboring Pocahontas County was confirmed on Monday. In Guthrie County, about 50 backyard birds were also infected, the department said. Before last week, the only reports of bird flu in recent months in the U.S. were sporadic appearances in backyard flocks or among wild birds such as ducks, geese, and eagles. While wild birds often show no symptoms of avian influenza, infections in them are a concern to the poultry industry as migration season gets underway. Migrating birds can spread the disease to vulnerable commercial flocks. Bird flu infections are relatively rare in humans and aren't considered a food safety risk, but as it hits other species, including some mammals, scientists fear the virus could evolve to spread more easily among people. Cambodia this week reported its third human death from bird flu this year. On page 3, we find a couple of news briefs. First, entitled Supervisors Cancel TextMyGov Contract. The Webster County Board of Supervisors voted to cancel the county's contract with TextMyGov, a service that uses smart texting technology to help connect residents with their local governments. The decision to cancel the contract was due to the service not being used much by residents, and the board felt it wasn't a good use of county funds to continue, Chairwoman Nikki Conrad said. According to the invoice sent to the county from TextMyGov, continuing the contract would cost the county $11,000 from November 2023 through October 2024. This contract cancellation only affects the county's contract with the service. It does not affect the contract the city of Fort Dodge has with TextMyGov. A second brief news story is entitled Illinois Mother Recuperates After Hate Crime Attack. A Palestinian American woman whose 6-year-old son was killed in what police are calling a hate crime in a Chicago suburb has asked the public to, quote, pray for peace, close quote, as she recuperates from her injuries. Hanan Sahin issued a statement Tuesday through the Chicago chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations after meeting with the group's executive director a day earlier. The written statement marked her first public comments since the brutal October 14 attack that left her with more than a dozen stab wounds and stitches on her face. Authorities said the family's suburban Chicago landlord singled them out because of their Islamic faith and as a response to the escalating Israel-Hamas war. Pray for peace, Shaheen said, thanking authorities, doctors, and others. She was released from the hospital last week and has declined interviews with reporters. The Messenger editorial in today's paper is entitled It's Time to Support Community Health Center. In Fort Dodge, those who do not have health insurance have an option for getting high-quality medical care. It's called the Community Health Center at Fort Dodge, and it offers medical, dental, and behavioral health care. While most insurance is accepted there, those who need a financial break will have their bills based on their ability to pay. It opened in 2006 and has been a key source of care for thousands of area residents since then. A chance for everyone to support the community health center that helps so many of our neighbors is now underway. It will conclude Saturday with an evening of food, laughter, and Halloween costumes. The upcoming event is called Costumes and Comedy. It will begin at 6 p.m. Saturday at Shimkat Motor Co., 3126 Fifth Avenue. Tickets are $45 in advance, or $50 at the door. They can be purchased at the Community Health Center, 126 North 10th Street, Shimkat Motor Co., or online at www.biddingforgood.com/CHC Fort Dodge. The featured entertainment Saturday evening will be Kevin Horner, a comedian, ventriloquist, and magician. The portion of the event that is already underway is an online auction featuring gift cards for local restaurants and other local goods and services. The auction items can be viewed at www.biddingforgood.com/CHC Fort Dodge. Raffle tickets for items to be given away during Saturday night's event can also be purchased on that website. All the money raised through the auction and Saturday's party will benefit the Community Health Center. Some of that money will be spent to buy a mobile dental office. This unit will be a motorhome with dentist chairs and other equipment inside. It will enable the health center staff to go on the road to provide needed dental care to people close to where they live. This event will allow people to have some fun and maybe win some special items during the raffle and auction. But most importantly, it will generate some money to ensure that the Community Health Center of Fort Dodge can keep on caring for people, whatever their financial or insurance status may be. On the opinion page, we also have an article entitled Quality of Life and Workforce by Astra Ferris, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance. Being a newcomer to the area, it is clear to see that our region's elected officials and leaders understand this and have invested time to work towards common growth goals. The importance of quality of life initiatives, such as attracting and retaining livable wage jobs, housing equity and stock, trails and culture, and other amenities, seems very top of mind when decisions are directed to action. Communities with a higher quality of life experience both higher employment and population growth. The collaboration is something we at the Growth Alliance practice day in and day out, and that's because it's imperative in the success of our region. Seeing all the forward thinking and collaborative action being done by the leadership in both local government and business is a positive outcome of many years of work to get here. Even regarding the challenges that our communities face, as many towns and cities across the country similarly do, one thing we do differently, we tackle them together. No one issue will be solved by one entity alone. Reliable infrastructure is also a part of maintaining a good quality of life. Infrastructure covers everything from roads and bridges to basic municipal needs like water, electricity, gas, and broadband. It also includes services like healthcare, childcare, educational opportunities, and further amenities that support the necessary workforce, our human infrastructure. Economic growth doesn't happen without serious investments and strategic planning with a master plan regarding infrastructure. Without infrastructure support, there are no new neighborhoods, shopping areas, entrepreneurial ecosystems, or other amenities we have grown to expect. A partner to economic development is the education opportunities available. Iowa Central Community College is also a part of our support infrastructure that is invaluable when it comes to offering options for adult learning, skilled workforce training, and development. The workforce is and has been of great importance for attracting and retaining businesses. With the great silver tsunami economists have alluded to, with the mass exodus of one of our larger generations, such as the baby boomers, employers are looking to find ways to bridge the generation gap as new generations enter the labor force. Automation has played a key role as technological advancements in recent years are being actualized at a much faster pace. But our educational partners will always be front and center for skilling up the labor force. One thing is clear to me, economic development and quality of life initiatives only happen when collaboration occurs between stakeholders, Fort Dodge, Webster County, and we all understand that when one wins, we all win. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for October 25, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.